This is Decisions and Dilemmas, a podcast for the Center for Ethics at the University of Toronto. On October 17th, 2011, the Center for Ethics hosted a panel discussion titled On the Very Idea of a Good War, Afghanistan 10 Years In. One of the panelists was Amir Attaran, professor in the faculties of law and medicine at the University of Ottawa, and holder of the Canada Research Chair in Law, Population Health, and Global Development Policy. Today's episode is a recording of Professor Attaran's talk, titled, Sir, Are War Crimes Part of the Mission, or the NATO Coalition's Bumbling Approach to Torture?
Thank you so much. This is supposed to be a time to talk about whether wars can be just. Now, I'm actually a really poor choice for speaker on this subject because I'm not a political scientist. I don't pretend to be. I don't have that skill set. I don't know how to think about those issues. I'm quite ill-schooled in those things. I'm a scientist and a lawyer, basically. That's how I was trained. And so rather than having any conceptual background, any theoretical background, I'm just a person of evidence. You know, as cut my teeth on clinical evidence and then courtroom evidence, and that's really all I understand. So rather than engage any of the philosophical questions about it, I'm going to try and approach this in a factual context. That's all I'm qualified to do. But I want to understand a bit about where those of you in the audience sit on these issues. So let me ask two questions, and if I could please ask a show of hands. Who thinks that law should apply in times of war and in war? Hands up, please. Okay. So who thinks law should not apply in times of war and in wars? Okay. That's brave. Good for you. Who thinks, second question, that in times of war, torture should be absolutely prohibited? Thank you. Who thinks that in times of war, torture may be justified? Okay. All right. Those were trick questions. And the way in which they were trick questions was they did bring out a few people in this audience who felt that law always should apply in war, but then also felt that torture could be used in war. And the difficulty with that position, though I'm sure the views were sincerely held, is that, of course, torture is, in fact, illegal in all places at all times, war or not war. That's just a reality. Whether one likes it or not, that is what the law says, and it's uncontroversial that the law says this. For those of you who want to look it up, it's the Convention Against Torture, which permits absolutely no exceptions to the prohibition. And yet, I'm glad to see there was a difference in the show of hands on the two questions, because that difference is the difference our society post 9/11 has been struggling with, and doing so in an extraordinarily murky way. And not one that is in any way consistent with law or principle. For Canada, we are not immune. While most of the discussion about torture in wartime has occurred in the US, having Guantanamo makes that happen, we also have been subject to the same dilemma, what to do in terms of this most strict of prohibitions during wartime. Will we set it aside or won't we? I think it's fairly clear that we did set it aside as a nation. This country of ours, which I love and I'm certain you do too, did engage with knowledge in torture in Afghanistan. We did it. It's awful to say, but we did it. And the way we did it, as most of you know from the news, is that we arrested persons in Kandahar, meaning the Canadian forces, and transferred them to units of the Afghan government that were extensively documented to make use of torture, particularly one unit called the National Directorate of Security, the NDS. You can think of the NDS as, by rough analogy, the Afghan version of the CIA. It is the secret police of Afghanistan. And for many years, it has been known that the NDS are not particularly gentle people. When they interrogate, they do so using means of abuse, of torture, in order to coerce information out of the person whom they're interrogating. And this has been known for a very long time. It probably has been true for all of the history of the NDS, although I don't really know that. I speculate it's been true since the beginning because they were trained by the Soviets. And the institution continues to this day. Now, when Canada went to southern Afghanistan and undertook its most serious combat mission in decades, we were unfortunately ill-prepared for the taking of detainees. You can't go to combat and not arrest people. You have to arrest people. It's folly to think that you can go to combat and not arrest them. And so, as much as you have to plan for feeding the troops, or housing the troops, or delivering guns and bullets and airplanes and all sorts of materiel, surely you have to plan for what you're going to do with detainees, do you not? Well, we didn't. Let me tell you how Canada came to the situation of having to arrest persons and not having an adequate solution. The decision to go to Afghanistan was made in some haste because there was pressure on this country to do something to support that war after having said no to Iraq. And the decision about how to deal with the tension was taken in a curious way. An agreement was signed on December 18, 2005, between General Hillier, who was at the time chief of the defense staff, the senior-most military man in the country, and his counterpart in Afghanistan. That agreement stipulated that Canada would transfer detainees to Afghanistan and Afghanistan would accept them. But extraordinarily, this agreement, signed between two nations, a treaty, basically, it's a treaty, was not signed by foreign ministers, it was not signed by ministers of defense, it was signed by Hillier. And it was signed on a date when, if you recall, December 18th of that year, there was an election underway. There was basically no minister at the wheel. For months before that, there had been efforts to hammer out an agreement on transferring detainees, but there was nothing that both sides could agree. And then, goodness knows how this happened, I don't know, when there was no minister at the wheel, General Hillier went and signed this thing. The agreement stipulated that we would transfer detainees, but it did not stipulate that we had any right to inspect their well-being after we transferred them. Out of sight, out of mind. And the agreement was secret. This treaty was secret. This was not true of other countries in the NATO coalition. Around the same time, Britain signed an agreement, the Netherlands, the Norwegians, the Danes. These agreements were public. And they all stipulated the right of the transferring country to go and inspect, to make sure that after transfer, the persons were being properly cared for, not Canada. We were the only exception there. And we also, as I say, were secretive. When Canada would not give me the agreement, the secret treaty that we'd entered into, and I knew that the Dutch had one, I got in touch with them and I said, could I please have a copy of your treaty? And they apologized profusely to me, saying, oh yes, we're very sorry, it'll take us a day to get it to you. But Canada kept it secret until it leaked. When it leaked, and it was clear that we had settled for a lower degree of protection, when General Hillier had settled for a lower degree of protection, I and others began to pose some questions. Why? Why would we not want to know that the persons we're transferring are being taken care of properly? Because actually, in international law, we must know. We have a residual obligation post-transfer. That's uncontroversial. I don't know why, but we didn't want to know. And yet there were warning signs. In report after report, the United Nations, Amnesty International, even the United States State Department, which of course is on very friendly terms with Afghanistan, wrote clearly that the NDS engages in abuse and torture. And they mentioned the methods: sexual humiliation, sodomy, the extraction of nails, burning, electric shock. These were expressly mentioned as the techniques. These reports were on the internet for anyone who wanted to read them. It later transpired in cross-examination of some military officials and court cases arising from this that no one in the military ever did read them. So we began transferring, quite willfully blind to the circumstances in which we were doing so. And unsurprisingly, torture happened. On November 5th, 2007, we had a very clear instance of it. By this time, Amnesty International and the BC Civil Liberties Association had sued the Canadian government. I was one of the counsel in that case. I was one of the lawyers. And 10 minutes before we were, literally 10 minutes before we were to appear and get an injunction from the federal court stopping transfers, we were given a new agreement that had been signed that morning in Kabul. We were in our gowns. We were ready to go. We were in the courtroom when we were given this new agreement 10 minutes before the hearing. And the new agreement did include that we would inspect. Well, we did. And on November 5th, 2007, in one of those inspections, a detainee was found badly beaten and claimed that he'd been abused after being transferred. The Canadian who questioned him was skeptical and said, "Well, how should I believe you?" And the detainee said, "Well, you see that chair over there?" "Yes." "Well, if you look under the chair, you'll see." So the Canadian walks over to the chair and moves the chair and finds whips located under the chair, which are consistent with the marks on his body. So this man not only claimed that he had been whipped, he actually was able to direct the Canadians to the place in the prison where the whips were kept. Fairly credible as evidence goes. A few months before that, Graham had done an expose for the Globe and Mail, the one that won him the missioner, quite deservedly, in which he interviewed a few dozen persons who had been released from custody after being transferred. And most of them claimed torture or other forms of abuse. It was no secret. And yet our military went on doing it and doing it and doing it. You probably saw the news about 3 weeks ago that NATO suspended the transfer of detainees to a large number of prisons in Afghanistan. Well, this is 2011. Why wasn't it done sooner? Everything I've told you about is from 2007. The reason it wasn't done sooner is because it was convenient to ignore the human rights of these persons. Perhaps it was convenient to make use of the NDS's rougher methods. There's a document that was leaked a few years ago, about 2 years ago now, in which a Canadian military intelligence official summarizes the detention of six persons in southern Afghanistan. And he ends his summary by saying, "These six persons were not, we felt, cooperative with our questioning. I recommend transferring to the NDS. What does that mean? Recommend transferring to the NDS, and the memo went on, "for further questioning." Those were the final three words of the memo. We had Canadian military intelligence recommending transfer to known torturers, quote, direct quote, "for further questioning." Well, the reason it stopped finally about 3 weeks ago is because the United Nations did a report. Well, what about those other reports I told you about? This report was a bit more graphic. This one depicted some of the methods that had been used. People were burned, electrocuted. One particularly gruesome method known as genital twisting was used. And on the strength of this, finally NATO had to say, enough is enough. Transfers are suspended now until NATO works out what else to do. Transfers were also suspended after November 5th, 2007 for about 2 months. Oddly, just the dates when we went to court, they were suspended. As soon as we were done with court, they resumed. There's no indication the situation has improved. Otherwise, you wouldn't have this UN report from only a couple weeks ago, talking about genital twisting and that sort of thing. But there seems to have been a decision made by NATO militaries, Canada's included. We'll look the other way. If it serves us, we'll look the other way. Now, I want to be absolutely clear. What Canada did in transferring persons to torture is in the law equally unlawful as Canada doing torture. It is unlawful to aid and abet a crime, just as it is unlawful to commit the crime. I think that's a fairly uncontroversial proposition of law. If you drive the getaway car from the bank robbery, you are part of the crime, even if you didn't pull the gun in the bank. No one seriously disputes this. And yet governments seem to think it is okay, NATO governments, many of them, to go on with this sort of transfer. It has been the subject of judicial review. In this country, we tried and we lost. The Supreme Court, in fact, refused to hear the case on appeal. We lost because the courts below, the Federal Court of Appeal was the final one, held that foreign persons in Afghanistan did not have the protections of human rights in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That the Charter simply didn't reach abroad that way. Which is a very curious thing, because the Charter is the highest law of the land. It's our Constitution. And yet much more pedestrian laws do reach abroad. The criminal code applies in Afghanistan. Presumably the soldiers are being paid. So the Financial Administration Act applies. The National Defense Act applies. Lower laws apply in Afghanistan, clearly. If the soldiers weren't being paid, we'd hear about it. But the Constitution doesn't apply. We're the only Western democracy now to take that view. Even the US, its courts have accepted that parts of the Bill of Rights, its human rights constitution, do apply in Cuba. At Guantanamo. The European countries in the Council of Europe, some 40-odd countries, not the European Union, but the Council of Europe, which is larger, all accept that the European Convention on Human Rights binds their militaries when they go abroad. Even Russia accepts that. There are cases right now before the European Court of Justice in Strasbourg involving cases brought by Georgians against the Russian government during the Russian invasion of Georgia. Russia does not dispute that it is bound by human rights law when its military goes abroad. We do dispute it. We are in a league of one. And so doctrinally, I'm sorry to say, Canada's human rights doctrine in wartime abroad, remember that question I asked you, should law apply in war? We are the only advanced country to answer that in the negative. We are doctrinally behind Russia. We are doctrinally behind the US. We are primitive in this way. In this country, the Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case. It was decided against us, so be it, for the reasons I've just described. But exactly the same case was brought in England, involving the question of whether the British forces could transfer to the NDS. The courts intervened and refused to permit the military to transfer to certain facilities. That decision wasn't even appealed by the British government. The Ministry of Defense accepted it. So in Britain, you can't do this. The courts say so. In this country, you can do it, and the courts say so. Similarly, the Council of Europe, its court in Strasbourg has found that time and time again, when European militaries go abroad, they are bound by human rights law. We're at the back of the pack, people. I'm sorry to tell you. Don't ever think of this as a country that leads on human rights. You would be incorrect. We are not. We're actually quite primitive in this regard. So I leave you with this thought. Quite apart from whether there is or is not such a thing as a just war. I can't answer that. Like I said at the beginning, I'm not a political scientist. I don't know. That's a conceptual question that I'm too dumb. I can't get there. I can look at the facts, though. And what I can conclude is, even if a just war governed by the rule of law is possible, this country is incapable of doing it. And that's very sad, because this country can contribute usefully in the projection of military force. I believe firmly in the responsibility to protect. I believe firmly that there will be cases where we need to use our military abroad for good purposes. Libya was one such example, controversial though it is. I think we did the right thing. But in Libya, in Afghanistan, or wherever we project our military force, we are incapable of applying our law, because that's what the courts say. So we, it stands to reason, can't do a just war. We literally cannot do a war that includes justice, that includes the law. And as long as we can't do that, we're a deficient country. And as much as I love this place, this is a shameful thing about us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Decisions and Dilemmas. For more information about this podcast or the Center for Ethics, visit ethics.utoronto.ca.